For those of you who were completely frustrated with the sources, I apologize. But the question over here really is one of authenticity and depth. And unfortunately, or fortunately, the only way to get to the proper sources is sometimes looking at the She'elot and Tshuvot, which don't appear in English. And the task of translating this material is really quite overwhelming. But I want to start with a couple of statements about this. And again, as I said, we'll see how far we get. In contemporary American life, and maybe this is true over the last 20, 30 years, even longer, the abortion debate has been one of the most profound debates, and maybe one of the things which decides elections and determines somebody's political affiliation and a person's outlook. And you generally, again, if we'll be very superficial, in public life in America, you generally hear about two different extremes. And I think anybody who's even haphazardly understanding 30% of the material would appreciate that Judaism does not easily fit into either of those extremes. Where exactly it does fit is a much more interesting question, although the answer to that question would really end up, and I'm not sure how much you understood that, would really depend on which rabbi you spoke to. Because among Jewish sources, there is an incredible debate regarding the issue of abortion. To me, the most interesting tshuva that we read, and not necessarily the most important one, but the most interesting one, was the one where Moshe Feinstein speaks about the political situation which goes on in America, and therefore why we have to be very, very strict, because he is fighting the what you would call the pro-choice position, because he thinks it's out of control. But I said, that's a political statement, and that's a very interesting political statement. But let's start off with the most basic point. In the dialogue that takes place, if it really is a dialogue, it's more like this noise. It's not a dialogue. You hear two different sides. What are the two positions? They're both extreme. One position is, a woman would say, it's my body, my choice. Beginning and the end of the discussion. The other extreme position would be that the woman has nothing to do with it, and it would be one which would really be most closely associated with the Protestant opinion, that the fetus has a right to life because the fetus needs to be baptized, and even if the mother's life... Catholic. And even if the mother's life is in danger, better for the mother to die in childbirth than the fetus not ever having the right to have a baptism. So that's also a very, very extreme position. And my suspicion is that most Americans find themselves someplace in the middle and not on either of those sides, but those are the two sides that you end up hearing the most. Judaism very, very clearly does not associate with either one of those sides. The main question, the fundamental question, is abortion considered to be murder? Or let me rephrase the question. Why would abortion not be allowed? James, what exactly is the implication, the legal implication, of performing an abortion? Which is, all of us understand, we don't have to, this is not subject to debate, all of us understand that if there is a human being and somebody else kills a viable human being, then the human being who is killed, in Judaism that's considered to be one of the Ten Commandments, that's lo tirtzach, do not commit murder. Does the prohibition of not committing murder apply to a fetus or not? So here's the surprise, and this should not be an extreme surprise, but it's one of the things that that sometimes people would be a little taken aback with. There is no discussion in the Talmud that discusses that point. I know that we would like to think that the Talmud discusses all kinds of things. The Talmud does not discuss that point. It's never brought up as a question. One who performs an abortion, what exactly is the prohibition? No discussion. I can't tell you it's a machloket Rabbi Akiva and Yishmael. I can't tell you that there's a unanimous point. There is no such discussion. What does that mean? What's the answer? What does that mean? Oh, it came up. I'm not sure. No, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what it means. Here, I'll give you another example. There's no clear Talmudic discussion, and I'm being very careful with my words. There's no clear Talmudic discussion about suicide.
So everything we have is afterwards?
No, you have to study all kinds of passages and discern from the passages. But again, here's what we need to get used to. Even though maybe we've been brought up to believe that every single thing is discussed in the Talmud, so here I'm telling you, it's not true. Not every single case is discussed in the Talmud. And when cases are not discussed in the Talmud, then later authorities are going to have to read between the lines or take parallel cases, as you saw over here was taking place. I mean, why in the world do they bring in a discussion of a woman who committed adultery and whether she's put to death or not to discuss the idea of abortion? Why are they bringing that into discussion? Do you now know why? Because there is no discussion on abortion. Again, not that abortion is never discussed. It is discussed. But what I would consider to be the fundamental question, if somebody kills a fetus, which prohibition have they broken? No discussion. So by the way, suicide. Let me just play with that for a second. And this will take us to next week's topic. With suicide, the fact that the Torah never tells us, the Talmud never tells us what verse you broke if you commit suicide, does that mean that suicide is allowed?
No.
Why?
Because you're taking a life. You know, it's a
so it may fit into the category of what we normally call murder, homicide, lo tirtzach. Who said that lo tirtzach is only if you kill somebody else? The fact that you call it suicide, that you gave it a different name, does that make any difference?
No.
Does it, aside from Cain and Abel, does the Torah have a direct prohibition against fratricide? What's fratricide?
Killing your
brother. Oh, so just because there's another name for it, does that mean that it's not taking a life?
No.
You can call it infanticide. I don't know if there's a word mother-in-law aside.
No,
what? Excuse me?
Right.
So I could conclude my discussion by saying, let's say regarding suicide, by saying the fact that Talmud never discusses it tells me nothing. Why? Because the Torah says lo tirtzach. I don't have to go any further. And I can say the same thing by abortion. Torah says lo tirtzach, and since it says lo tirtzach, therefore it's murder, and there's nothing to talk about. However, that's not so simple. So I'm saying, yeah, exactly. That's not so simple. Still, if you get nothing else out of the class today, one thing you'll now realize is not every single case is discussed in the Talmud. And because not every single case is discussed in the Talmud, there are lots of post-Talmud discussions, and you're going to have, again, consequently, when it comes to the prohibition of abortion, you are going to have more range than almost any other halakhic question that you've ever considered. And I'll tell you how broad the range is. From some saying it is murder, to those saying it's almost murder, and I'll try to show you where that comes from, to those who will say that there is no Torah prohibition, to those who are going to say it's basically the same thing as birth control. Because in both cases, you're frustrating a life to come to its fruition, and therefore, there's birth control. Earlier stages, later stages, which, by the way, is a major consideration by how exactly the IUD works. Because, and even among doctors who discuss IUD, it's not so simple if every single IUD necessarily frustrates pregnancy. Some frustrate birth and not necessarily pregnancy because it's after the egg is ovulated, after conception.
I'm not mistaken, I think in Israel, the main way of using birth control is abortion.
Well, that's a little cynical. Since when are you cynical? But I'll tell you where and when it was true. that was true in the Soviet Union. It was true in the Soviet Union 20 years ago. That was the case. Yeah, when there was virtually no. It's the 3 weeks.
It sounds like we should all
expand. Where there was virtually no contraception, but you did have a state-run medical situation whereby you'd be able to deal with pregnancies, but not to prevent pregnancies. The cynics who would make the statement about Israel would probably be talking more about in the army, where it is well known that an Israeli woman soldier, male soldiers doesn't work for, women soldiers are allowed to have their first abortion and they go back into their regular unit after the second abortion, which is free in the army as well, then they'll be discharged from the army. So, what? If any of you want to join the army. Okay. The discussion in the Mishnah in Ohalot, which is the first source, the reason it says 55 is because there were 54 sources prior to this. Ha'isha shehimak sheleled, a woman who is having a hard time giving birth. Here we're talking about a woman who is in the ninth month, arguably. Because, by the way, you all appreciate that makes it more difficult. And by the way, this is something about Mishnah, and to a lesser extent Gemara, but something that you find in Mishnah. It will bring the most extreme case, because if I clarify the most extreme case, then I will have clarified the less extreme cases. Ha'isha shemakshe lele, the woman who is having a hard time giving birth. In today's world, doctors, thank God, can deal with this a lot better than they were able to deal with this 2,000 years ago. 2,000 years ago, if the baby is breech, if the baby, again, the cord, I mean, you can have all kinds of situations. Today, you know, today you can have a C-section, which is, I love the way they call it a C-section. They don't call it major abdominal surgery. They just, you know, just have a C-section and so on. Ha'isha shimakshe leled mechadchin et havlad b'meyeha umotzin oto evarim evarim. I'm sorry that this is grotesque. It says a woman who is having a hard time giving birth, one is even permitted, when necessary. One is even permitted to cut the fetus into little pieces and take it out piece by piece. Now, of course, you would say, why do this? Just perform a C-section, right? A cesarean. Yes, they had cesareans then. And the reason they called it cesareans, because Caesar was born through a cesarean. The only problem is that there was an incredibly high likelihood that the woman would not survive the major abdominal surgery. I mean, in today's world, if you cut somebody's abdomen, then you have a chance of avoiding infection, and you have a chance of sewing them up and they're surviving. In that world, you did not have that much of a chance. And therefore, over here, we're talking about a case where a woman is having, she's in danger. She is, her life is, according to the doctors, it does not look like she will survive. It's a case of sakanaf nefashot. It's a case of pikuach nefesh. What is the determination over here? You're allowed to kill the fetus. Why? It says, it makes a value judgment, mipnei shechayeho kodmin lechayav. Because the life of the mother takes precedence over the life of the fetus. Now that's a value judgment. We're not told why that value judgment takes place. We're not told in the mission over here, what are the inner workings for this? We're told one of precedence, the mother's life takes precedence over the fetus's life. Yotza rubo, if most of the baby has come out, and over here there is a difference of opinion, if you noticed in the Gemara, whether rubo is one which is qualitative or quantitative. What did the Gemara say instead of rubo? The Gemara said rosho. So rosho would be not one of quantity, but one of quality. Yotza rubo, ein noginbo. Then you're not permitted to touch the fetus. She'ein dochen nefesh mipnei nefesh. For you're not allowed to push aside one nefesh for another nefesh. What can we conclude from this? One is you can conclude that there is a lack of nefesh till at least the head comes out. What else can you conclude?
That the mother's life.
The mother's life went. And what else can you conclude?
That
you can conclude that there are times that an abortion is allowed. You can also conclude what? And you can also conclude that there is a problem with performing an abortion when the mother's life is not in danger, but we don't know what that problem is. Right? Because otherwise I would not have to get to this kind of extreme case. Otherwise I could have had my starting point. House is too small. Not all the kids are going to have their own bedrooms. Therefore have an abortion. But that's not the case that it brought in. What was the case that it brought in? It brought in a case of the mother's life is in danger. What can I then understand that were a case where the mother's life is not in danger, there would be a problem of having an abortion. What is the problem? That we're not told. That source clear? Yes? What?
That was an easy
Next source. Amar Rav Huna. Rav Huna said, Katan harodev mitan latzilo benafsho. A katan who is a rodef, you can save him by killing by taking his life. Now, first of all, what is a rodef? A rodef is a pursuer. Here's the theoretical case of rodef. Somebody's running down the block, chasing somebody else, has a machete in his hands, screaming, "I will kill you!" Mm-hmm. Right? You're watching on the side. What do you do? So if it's today's world, you take out your video camera, then sell it to the highest bidder afterwards, right? But if you somehow choose not to take the higher moral ground, what is one supposed to do? What one is supposed to get involved. And how does one get involved? One tries to save the victim.
Right.
Now, there is a machloket rishonim, which really comes down to a philosophical question. When you save the victim, you're allowed to even kill the perpetrator, right? Now, why are you killing the perpetrator? Are you killing the perpetrator to save the victim,
yeah,
or are you still killing the perpetrator to save the perpetrator from becoming a perpetrator? Now, if you say that sounds very strange, which chapter does this appear in Gemara Sanhedrin? It appears in a chapter which is called chapter Ben Sorer Umorah. What does it say about Ben Sorer Umorah? That you kill the Ben Sorer Umorah, that he never becomes far worse. Within the discussion, the Mishnayot which follow Ben Sorer Umorah, we find the case of Rodef. There is a machloket between Rashi and the Ran when it says that when it says, Eilin hein shematzilin oto benafshan. These are those that you can save by their souls. Rashi will say, who are you saving? You're saving the victim. You're saving the one who's being chased. The Ran says, who are you saving? You're saving the perpetrator. You're saving the rodef from becoming a murderer. Which means, here's the more practical question. When you get involved, I guess you would call this, if you were influenced by the New Testament, you would call yourself a good Samaritan. Correct? The good Samaritan who becomes involved and wants to try to stop this murder from taking place. What is their role at this point? Are they a police officer trying to prevent a crime? Or are they judge and jury and we're saving the middleman? Right? Save taxpayers lots of money. Just go straight to the execution part. Because anyway, if somebody's going to be guilty of murder, you're going to end up executing them. So that's the philosophical question. If you're going to decide that you, by the way, what's the difference? Or as we say when we study Gemara, we say, what's the nafgamina? Now, what's the practical difference if you're judge or jury, or if you're a police officer? What will be the difference? The difference will be a katan. Why? Because if a katan was going to do a crime, do you stop the katan from doing the crime? Yes. Will a katan get punished for the crime? No.
No, not a minor.
So if do you understand the difference now? That's the starting point of this Gemara. A katan who is a rodef, what is your level of interaction? Are you acting as a police officer to prevent the crime from taking place? Or are you acting as the judge and jury, meeting out punishment, saying the taxpayers lots of money in the middle? What's the conclusion of the Gemara? And how do you know this? How do you know it's because it says you get involved? Again, realize a katan, somebody, a male under 13, a female under 12, are not responsible for their actions. No beitin can give them a punishment afterwards. Do you still stop them if they're a rodef? Let's read the Gemara now. Amarav, katan harodef, nitan l'tzil b'nafsho. A katan who's a rodef, you're still allowed to kill them to prevent the crime from taking place, which would seem to lead in the direction that you're saving. That you're saving the victim. By the way, you could claim the other way around. You can claim that you're still saving them from doing the crime, even. You can't argue that way? No, you can't.
The language is that I was thinking something clear. Entirely different. During the Holocaust, the fact was that a baby was crying in the bunker that they killed in order to save them.
Okay, let's go on. We'll see. Let's go on. It says, Katan harodif nitam sil banafsho, kosavar. Rodef einu tzarich hatra'ah. This follows the opinion that a rodef doesn't need to be warned. Generally, in order to give out punishment, you need to warn somebody. To warn somebody, they need da'at, they need understanding. A katan doesn't have proper understanding. So therefore, you would say, this then proves that the whole idea of saving the victim, like the law of rodef, it's not one where there's going to be a warning, because there can't be a warning in the case of a katan. It says, doesn't need hatra'ah, lo shna gadol v'lo shna katan. Doesn't make a difference. You're talking about somebody who is an adult or somebody who's a child. Eitzvei Rav Chista the Rav Huna. Rav Chista asked in front of Rav Huna, yotz, and he brought our mission that we started with. Again, he changed it from Ruvo to Rosho. Yotza Rosho, ein noginbo. If the head comes out, you don't touch them. Lefi she'ein doch nefesh v'fnei nefesh. Because you don't push one life aside for another life. V'amai rodefu. Why don't we say that this infant, whose head is already out, I'm not calling it a fetus at this point, this infant is a rodef. So the Gemara says, Shani hatam de mishmaya karadfile, that this woman is being pursued from heaven and not from this infant. So let's go back a second. This Gemara was talking about rodef. This Gemara wanted to know if a child can be considered a rodef. The answer of this Gemara was yes. Just hold it. That therefore tells me that when it comes to stopping a crime, I don't need to warn them. When you need to warn somebody, let's say for example by Shabbat, someone's about to break Shabbat. You stop. You say, hold it. It's Shabbat today. You're not allowed to do that on Shabbat. That's called hatra'ah, warning. No beitin can give any punishment unless the person was warned beforehand. Does the law of rodef, stopping somebody from committing a crime, does that fit into the normal legal procedures and you need to be warned and to quote the verse and so on and so forth? Or is this preventing a crime and therefore a different process? What does the Gemara seem to say over here? Preventing a crime is a different process. The question then comes, what about the case of the child who was born, the mother's life is still in danger, why don't we say then that this child is a rodef? So the Gemara gives a very strange answer. What's the answer? No, that's not the answer that it gives. Because it's from heaven. It's from heaven. What does Rashi say? Rashi explains the whole case. 57. Yotza Rosho, Beisha Makshelaleid Umisukenet. A woman who's having a difficult time giving birth and her life is in danger. Uktani Rasha, the first part said, quoting from the Mishnah, Hachaya poshet the one who's helping you give birth, poshet yadav v'chotcho umotziu le'ivarim, the midwife is allowed to cut up the fetus. The kolzman shaloyotz lavir ha'olam lav nefeshu. Okay, Rashi said what we discerned from the first source, that the whole time that the fetus's head does not come out, it's not considered to be a nefesh. V'nitan lahargo u'latziu le'imo, and you're allowed to kill it to save the mother's life. Aval yatsa rosho, but if the head did come out, ein nogin bo lahargo, you're not allowed to kill the child. The havale kiyalud, because at that point it's born, the ein doch nefesh v'bnei nefesh. And then you're not allowed to take a choice, say this life is better than this life. Now, what does all this do for me in terms of the question of abortion? But what does this do for us in terms of our discussion of abortion?
It allows it in the circumstances.
So first of all, it's clear to us, it allows us in a certain sort. Secondly, there's another very strong point. What is it telling us? Is that there's something about a fetus, even the ninth month, which is not a full person. Right? There's something which is lacking. Now what is the implication of that? We're still not completely sure. But if the head was already out, then it's a complete person, and then you can't make any kind of moral judgment that one life is more important than the other, and that's just considered to be a tragedy, and it's from heaven, and we can't solve every tragedy. Theoretically, if you're standing on top of a mountain, and you see two trains, and for some reason the tracks, the lights are broken, and the trains are on the same track, and they're about to meet, and they can't see one another. You happen to have a shoulder rocket launcher. Can you shoot one train off the mountain and save at least one train? Can you make that moral decision? Again, same question. Can you make that? That becomes a very difficult moral decision. By the way, this is discussed. The Chazon Ish discusses this. Are you allowed to say, hold it, rather than both lives be taken, let me at least save one life? There is a certain type of logic involved in this. Let's go on. The Rambam in Source 58, which is, and any of you who have never understood why the Rambam has become so important in terms of halacha, I can't answer you why that is, but the Rambam's formulation over here is very, very careful and really becomes the starting point for most people in terms of the discussion. Let's read what the Rambam says. First of all, where did the Rambam write this? He's writing in Hilchot Rotzeach Ushmirat Nefesh, Chapter 1, the laws of murder and saving life. Hareza mitzvot lo taseh shel alchos al nefesh harodef. There is a prohibition that one is not allowed to feel bad for the rodef. You can't say, oh, what a sweet rodef. And no, you have to protect the victim. One is not allowed to feel bad for the rodef. To have compassion. Lefichach, therefore, horu chachamim, therefore, the sages have instructed, Sha'ubra shehimakshe leled, mutar lechtocha ubar b'meyeha, bein basam, bein b'yad, nei shehu kirodef achareha lahorga. Therefore, the sages have instructed, when a woman is having a hard time giving birth, one is permitted to terminate the pregnancy, whether you're talking about using some kind of medication. The Rambam, who we all know and appreciate, was a well-known doctor. He says whether using medication or whether physically doing this. Why? Shehu kirodef achare lahorga. For this child is a rodef. Did I say that correctly or no? Did I translate that correctly or no? Right. The Rambam did not say the child is a rodef. What did the child say? Kirodef. Now, by the way, let's think a second. Did the Gemara discuss this case? Was this the case the Gemara discussed?
No.
What was the case the Gemara discussed? The Gemara discussed a katan, a child, and the Gemara discussed the newborn. What did the Gemara say about the newborn? The newborn is not a rodef, that's from heaven. What did the Rambam just now do? The Rambam just now took a leap. What was the leap? I'm not saying it's a bad leap. What was the Rambam's leap? The Rambam said the fetus is a case of rodef. Nobody said that before the Rambam. Do you all see that? What did the Mishnah say? The Mishnah said if the woman's having a hard time giving birth, you can cut up the child. Why? It didn't tell us why. To save the mother's life. The mother's life takes precedence. The Mishnah and the Gemara did not give us the inner dynamics of how this works. Are you ladies with me? The Rambam over here, by adding in one letter, the Kaf HaDimyon, created, I would say, an entire literature comes because of this one letter. Again, his formulation is fascinating. What's he saying? We are aware that there are times that you're allowed to take a life. When? Self-defense. Or this situation of rodef. The Rambam took the abortion discussion and he throws it into the rodef discussion in order to find a reason why one would be permitted to save the life of the mother. And therefore he's saying that the fetus becomes conceptually no different than the one who's chasing down the street with a machete screaming, I'm going to kill you, where you're allowed to kill the one who's the pursuer to save the pursued. But the Rambam didn't quite say that. He took it one level down, because what did he say? Because he says, Ki Rodev and not Rodev. Now what does that do for me? Let's just play with that for a second. We'll read to the end of the paragraph, and then we'll come back to that. Ki Rodev acher lohargav, im misha hotzei rosho, but once the head comes out, ein no ginbo, then you don't touch the fetus. She'ein doche nefesh mipnei nefesh. V'zehu tiv osha olam. That's a natural tragedy that you can't solve. What's the natural tragedy? Once the fetus is already mostly out, and it's a fetus, has complete life, and then you're not able to make this discussion. But by the way, if the fetus, if it's a rodef, then why isn't it a rodef afterwards? If it's a rodef, why is it not a rodef? But why isn't it a rodef? The mother's life is still in danger. Why is it not a rodef afterwards?
This child is not intentionally pursuing its mother.
So does intention make a big difference according to the Rambam? Does intention make a difference?
No.
How do you know that? The next paragraph. The next paragraph. What's the next paragraph? Yeah, go ahead. Right. Exactly. One second. Why shouldn't the mother be considered to be a rodef to the fetus? Kill the mother, save the fetus. Right? Which means afterwards, each one of them should be considered to be a rodef to the other one. For some reason, the Rambam is telling me beforehand, the fetus is considered to be a rodef pursuing the mother's life. Afterwards, he no longer uses the rodef argument. The fetus is challenging the mother's life, and the mother's challenging the fetus's life. At that point, the Rambam says, you can't do anything. Now, why was that not the case beforehand?
Why was the mother challenging the fetus?
It's not allowing the fetus to live. It's having a hard time giving birth. Mothers do terrible things to their kids.
But what if the head is out, close to the birth of the mother, you'll complete it, it doesn't take much longer than the rest of the body that comes.
Yeah, but again, in those days, I think what you're talking about is a fetus which is partially out, and now the mother's life at this point is in danger. The fetus's life is in danger because it can't continue this way. And basically, we have something which isn't resolvable, which is either you're going to have to kill the fetus and save the mother, or save the mother and kill the fetus. That's the situation. So what's interesting is beforehand, the Rambam says, Kirodev. Afterwards, he says, no, you can't do anything. But why can't you do anything? Apparently, and I think this is what you meant, apparently, the Rambam is understanding that at this point, each one has an equal claim to life, and neither of them can say, hold it, you are a Rodev on my life because there's an equal claim. That's what sounds like is going on over here. We'll see the implication of this, hopefully, fairly soon.
Yes. Are there cases where the mother's fine, but the mother's attacking the baby, and the mother's at the heart age, and the antibodies, the baby's threatened?
Baby or fetus?
Before it's
so emerging. We have to be careful. So fetus.
You could say baby by taking it out of the mother before it's affected by the antibodies.
Look, the reality in these cases, you're right. So it's not going to... It was a non-case then, because the only way to do it was killing the mother, and I don't think there would have been a reason to. Right. Okay, let's go back to this Kirodev problem. What's the matter? Listen, morally, you can certainly make that argument. Okay, now, what do we do with this Kirodev? How many of you can name all the chief rabbis in the history of Israel? Okay, Rav Kook, Rav Herzog, who is next? Rav Unterman, excellent. Rav Unterman and people skip for whatever reason. They go straight to Rav Gorin. Rav Unterman, he wrote a very important essay on this problem. And he said as follows, this was his logic. If the reason you're allowed to kill the fetus is that it's kirodev, but not rodev. What about killing the fetus in a situation where the mother's life isn't threatened? Killing the fetus because you want to kill the fetus. What would be the prohibition? Right. So what would be the prohibition? So he says the prohibition would be ki ritzicha. Right? Okay. If the Rambam over here is telling us that you're allowed to kill the fetus because it's ki rodev, it's like a rodev, why say it's like a rodev? It is a rodev. So he claimed that in a situation where the fetus is not a rodev, where just a woman wants to have an abortion, what would the prohibition be? It would be ki ritzicha. Now, what exactly does that mean, ki ritzicha? What is ki ritzicha? Let's right. So what does that mean, like murder? Why? But what does that mean? When it says like murder, why is it not murder? Or how much like murder is it? So, you all know that there are three things that you're not permitted to do, that you're better to give up your life than to do. Gilui Arayot, Shfichut Damim, Ve'avodah Zarah. Right? Right. Sexual sins, murder, and idolatry. The Gemara tells us that there's such a thing which is called Abizrayhu. Don't worry, I'm not making up this word. Any of you who live in modern Israel know there's such a thing. Avizirei Rechev. What's Avizirei?
Accessories.
But Abizrayhu is something which is like. Abizrayhu de Gilui Arayot is something which is like Gilui Arayot, not quite Gilui Arayot. The Gemara in Pesachim, for example, has a whole discussion. It is a whole discussion. What is the situation where there's a man who's deathly ill, and he somehow convinces his psychiatrist that he will die unless he has relations with a particular woman? So what does the Gemara say? Let him drop dead. Right? The Gemara doesn't have a long debate about this. Let him die. What's the meaning? And by the way, the Gemara doesn't even begin to get into discussion. Is she married? Is she not? Meaning, this person will die unless he has relations with this woman. So the Gemara said, what are you talking about? So he'll die. So then the Gemara goes on to say, okay, what if we're able to take it down a level instead of having relations with her? Maybe he'll just look at her naked. Or maybe the Gemara goes into various levels of this. At the end, the Gemara ends up concluding, let him die. But why? You're not dealing with actual Gilui Arayot at some point. You've taken it down a level, but it's still considered to be Abizrayhu de Gilui Arayot. What's Abizrayhu de Gilui Arayot? It's close, it looks like it, it's almost it, it's not quite it. And the Gemara says, but the same law applies. The same law applies by Abizrayhu. You can also have Abizrayhu to Avodah Zarah. You can have certain things which are the proper way to do Avodah Zarah, and then there could be other things which are not exactly Avodah Zarah. I mean, again, I'm not going to get into examples of this, other than to just say, for argument's sake, let's say in order to real Avodah Zarah, you have to do a sacrifice. And maybe just bowing down is not considered. Or maybe bowing down for another reason. You know the whole story with Chana and her kids? And by the last kid, bow down just to pick up the ring, and it will look like it. That, by the way, is not Avodah Zarah. That's Abizrayhu. But even then, the kid decides that he's going to die rather than even giving the impression. But it's interesting because that's not a Avodah Zarah anymore. You all know the reference that I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So you could have situations of Abizrayhu de Gilui Arayot. You could have a situation of Abizrayhu de Avodah Zarah. Can you have Abizrayhu to Ritzicha? So that's what Rav Unterman suggested. Why would this be Abizrayhu? So what's he saying? Morally, it's murder. Halachically, it's murder. Why is it not real murder? What are you lacking? What do you... No? No. I'm talking about... A victim. You're lacking a bona fide victim. What's the victim lacking to be a bona fide victim? It's not quite a nefesh. So according to Rav Unterman, what do you end up having? A Torah prohibition of murder? But he'll have to admit it's like murder. Why is it like murder? Because you don't have quite a full victim. But morally, it is the exact same thing as murder. This type of logic, I'm not even now claiming identical logic, this type of logic is one which Rav Soloveitchik had, it's one which Rav Moshe Feinstein had, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach had, and a number of other very significant poskim. By realizing that, again, I'll make it simpler now, by realizing that only in the extreme case, where the woman's life is in danger, does the Mishnah come and say, in such a case, can you kill the fetus? It tells me in all of the cases, you can't kill the fetus. And therefore, it tells me that we're talking about an extreme prohibition. What prohibition? They'll say murder. Where do they get it from? As I said, the Rambam over here, it says it's kirodef, so the only way to save the mother's life was because it's kirodef, so therefore, in a case where it's not a kirodef, what would you then have? Kiritzicha, right? Abizrael diritzicha. Did that work? What's the matter?
No, because
what's the bottom line? We're not at the bottom line. But I'm saying, in order to develop the argument that abortion would be a Torah prohibition, that would be pretty much at least one articulation of it, but I think one which is pretty clear from the sources that we saw. Okay? Because if, for example, all that abortion was the same thing as birth control, which I'm telling you is claimed by some authorities, would I have to work so hard? What would I say? I would assume that all of you know that to ask a rabbi for hetzer for birth control is a lot easier than asking, at least most rabbis, is a lot easier than asking for a hetzer for an abortion. And I'm saying if that's the case, then why would we have to work so hard, get to a case where the mother's life is in danger and so on? Just say, okay, what's the problem? So kill the fetus. So because of the difficulty over here is why, as I said, a number of authorities, again, through the ages, have seen it in the most serious light. But what was my starting point? This is by no means universal, and you have a great range of opinions here.
What about, things that people do that can just endanger the child, taking any kind of drugs, right, where there's a probability that they will kill the child, possibility they'll kill the child, they'll kill the fetus?
Yeah.
They're not doing it because of that reason.
Right, so morally,
they're doing it for their own reasons why they want to take the continue their lifestyle and effort.
Right. Secondhand smoke.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to prosecute for it. You could, by the way, you could sue for
that. I'm talking about someone who's intentionally doing all these things and disregarding the equipment. And then.
It's ultimately going to be very difficult. Guess she knows how to use the phone. It's ultimately going to be very difficult in any case where you don't have an actual crime. When I say actual crime, I mean murder, take a knife and kill somebody, to prosecute. On a moral level, is there responsibility? Absolutely. Okay. Let's move over a little bit more then. When you started to get lost in the world of the Shelot and Tshuvot, what I did want you to see there was really one thing. And then again, I apologize for the frustration level and the difficulty of some of the texts over here. But just trust me on this. There wasn't really an easy way of doing this. There is an incredible range. If you noticed in Source 61, Rav Moshe goes crazy against two people. One he names, the other he lets remain nameless. The one that he names is the Ya'avetz, who is known as Rav Yaakov Emden. Ya'avetz stands for Yaakov Ben Tzvi, Rav Yaakov Emden. Yaakov Emden lived approximately 200 years ago. He started the biggest fight of his generation, got into a fight with his local rabbi. They lived around the corner from one another, and they only met once or twice over 20 years, but they wrote put pamphlets against one another. Basically, they brought the whole European rabbinic world into uproar. Everyone was in Chayim from one or the other. If you weren't in Chayim, you were nobody. He was a great Talmud Chacham, whose father, the Chacham Tzvi, was even a greater Talmud Chacham, Rav Yaakov Emden had one thing which in today's world would not mean all that much to you because our worlds have changed so much. But he was very dangerous because he had apparently a short fuse and a printing press, which is a very, very bad combination. But therefore, by the way, he was incredibly prolific, put out books and pamphlets and all. And again, he was a great Talmud Chacham. His adversary was Yonasan Eifshitz, who was most likely even a greater Talmud Chacham. But as I said, that's a whole other discussion. Rav Yaakov Emden considers the following logic, which Rav Moshe thinks is ridiculous and shouldn't even be mentioned. What was the logic that he brought? He said that in the case of a woman who had an affair and got pregnant, and there were edim, there were witnesses that she had an affair, what would happen in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, time of the Sanhedrin? What would you do? You take out the woman and kill her. But if you take the woman, what about the fetus? Do you wait for her to give birth? No. So what does that tell you? It tells you that the fetus should also be put to death. So the fetus should be put to death. Therefore, in a situation today, we don't go killing the woman, but if the woman gets pregnant because she had an affair, you can go do an abortion because it's no different. And Rav Moshe says, what? Where was the analogy over here? Rav Moshe said that made no sense whatsoever. This should not be quoted. This should not be brought into discussion. This should never be even considered because he says it's absurd.
Yeah.
I don't think he quite said that, but you know what is interesting? It comes out according to this approach that the fetus is part of the woman. I don't want to go into this whole thing of choice. By the way, you want to see something of choice, which is interesting, which I'm not going to solve for you? Go back to the Rambam for a second. What do the Rambam say? The Rambam wrote in the middle of the second line, Mutar l'chtocha ubar. Why didn't he say chayav l'chtocha ubar? Is that a good question?
Yeah.
That does sound like he's leaving it as a question of choice and not one of obligation. Go to your local rabbi and say, I was learning this Rambam. I had a little difficulty. Why does Rambam write Mutar in this case? The logic is, if he's a Rodev, it should have been Chayav. Let me know if they have a good answer. Let's go on. It does sound, according to Rav Yaakov Emden, that the mother is a person. The mother's not subhuman. The mother's a person who's guilty to be killed. But the fetus, therefore, in his understanding, is part of the mother. So as the mother should be killed, the fetus should be killed. So, but now that should be a full stop. But then he's separating the fetus from the mother and says, no, the fetus is not part of the mother. So the fetus is not part of the mother. The fetus has a death penalty as much as the mother does, which is simply not true. Because let's even say in those days, by the time the trial took place, the baby was born, were they chased down the baby and killed the baby? Certainly not. So how can you go and say that in this case, abortion is allowed? What's really the issue? The real issue is, what's your starting point? If killing a fetus is a Torah law, if killing a fetus is a rabbinic law, if killing a fetus is less than a rabbinic law, that's really your problem. A fetus. Again, let's not go from fetus to baby. Those are that's the whole issue. Is that it's not exactly the same thing. The other person who he quotes, not by name, he writes that he read in a journal called Asya that a certain rabbi was allowing certain things to take place in Shari Tzedek Hospital, a situation where the mother was past the third month. The fetus was past the third month, and the baby was diagnosed with Tay-Sachs. And this particular rabbi allowed an abortion past the third month. Who is this nameless rabbi that he's talking about? It's Rabbi Waldenberg, who's a very, very old man today, known as the Tzitz Eliezer, because for many, many years he was the rabbi of Shari Tzedek Hospital. So even though Rav Moshe said, I don't want to say who it is, by saying he wrote it in Asya, so you just have to look it up, and he allowed in Shari Tzedek Hospital, that was basically telling everybody who he's talking about, except for those of us who don't know. But again, it's very clear who it is. And he was absolutely upset with this. He disagrees with this, but let's get to really the point. Rav Lichtenstein once wrote an article about this. Rav Lichtenstein once wrote an article about this, and he showed that from rabbinic sources, the third month is irrelevant. What's the issue of the third month? Third month is a question of pregnancy. So at which the third month in halakhic sources has nothing to do with fetus. It has to do with the woman's status as being pregnant, which means in terms of laws of nida and other things, in terms of when a woman is pregnant. But it has nothing to do with the status of the fetus. There's no discussion in the Gemara that brings up that brings up 3 months as something which is significant. By the way, that doesn't stop a lot of poskim seeing 3 months as important time. I'll tell you right now a secret. Rabbi Waldenberg allowed when he was really functioning, allowed abortions in the third month, in the fourth month, and I know a case of after the fifth month that he allowed. Again, where a baby was not considered to be viable, but was still quite alive, that he allowed. In order to do this, Rabbi Waldenberg will clearly have to have a very, very different understanding about what the prohibition is in abortion. If we'll skip a little bit, and along the way, you may have seen Rav Moshe dealing with some other issues, including problems of psychological issues, which I'm not going to get into right now. In source 64, page 4 on the bottom, Uve'emet re'iti b'shut rav pa'alim Shom she'davar she'alato hayta gamkin al davar eshet ish shezinta v'nit abra biznut, a married woman who had an affair and got pregnant. Imuteret l'shtot davar she'tapila ubar, if she's allowed to take the morning after pill, or for that matter, some kind of medication that will perform an abortion. Ach she'kvar hukar v'nigmar b'tna he chodashim, by the fifth month. V'acharei she'bidivrei tshuvato tzitet b'ktzara ma she'katav b'zeh b'maharit hachavat ya'ir v'haya'avetz mavli b'sukumav pitchon ped lahatir she'ish lomu mizeh b'ma'ayan ma she'katav. Which means he says that he starts quoting all these other opinions and he ends up allowing it. Among the opinions that he's quoting is that there is no clear prohibition of abortion. Once he goes in that direction, you will now understand how Rav Waldenberg is going to end up having such an easy time allowing in the third month, fourth month, and fifth month, certainly in cases where the mother's life is in danger, that there's nothing to talk about. The harder case will be as the case that Rav Moshe quoted from Rav Waldenberg. What case was that? A case where of a Tay-Sachs baby, and I don't think that I have to tell you, a Tay-Sachs baby is going to have a very short, a very painful, and a very tragic life. And revolt, and then the parents have to deal with it. And so on, also going to have, you know, an incredibly tragic situation. And, I mean, I know somebody who their oldest son was diagnosed with Tay-Sachs when the mother was pregnant with the second child. I mean, that's not a very simple situation. Rav Waldenberg allowed it. His starting point is very different. He's again. This is what's fascinating. He's just not coming from the same place that Rav Moshe is coming from. Rav Moshe is looking at it as murder. Rav Soloveitchik looked at it as murder or like murder. They're coming from a whole different place. But it's not, again, you realize it's not just Rav Waldenberg. He's quoting a whole bunch of other poskim, some of which you already saw Rav Moshe said, I don't want to hear their names. I don't want to hear about it because there's nothing to talk about. But what we should appreciate is the range between them. I do want to mention one other thing which I found remarkable. Source 66 is the conclusion of the Tzitz Eliezer. Here you have some 18 considerations of when he will allow an abortion. You'll read that on your own. I'm not going through them. What I did find remarkable was, and this was just published very recently, Rav Herschel Schechter from YU, he has written a number of articles on Rav Soloveitchik's approach to Psak. And one of the things that he brings up is how Rav Soloveitchik would paskin different things for different people. I know some of you may find this somewhat strange and somewhat disturbing. But different people give different answers. One of the things that he was trying to get through in this particular section was that Rav Soloveitchik would give a different psak for people that were his students, who wanted to know what he did and wanted his opinion, versus people who would ask a more general question, and then he would say, well, there are those who would allow this without really saying what he thought. And he would very much depend on who asked. A couple of years, 2 years ago, there was a book which was published about Tzniut, about covering the hair. And in the article, it says, somebody wrote about Rav Soloveitchik, and says there are rumors that he would give a psak allowing women not to cover the hair, not to cover their hair. So I found this a little surprising, being that I know that my father discussed it with him directly and asked him, is a woman obligated to cover her hair? And his answer was, absolutely. And then my father started walking away, and he called him back, and he said, but it's her mitzvah, not your mitzvah. That was, again, that's, is that word for word? No coercion. No coercion. It's her mitzvah. So right after this book, this review of the article came out of the Jerusalem Post on Friday. On Saturday night, I get on the plane. And who sits next to me on the plane? Rav Lichtenstein, which means I couldn't watch any movies. I couldn't do anything. totally ruined the flight for me. But we did discuss this. And I said to him, I said, you know, how could somebody quote him as saying this? So he said, he goes, I could tell you. He gave different psakim to different people. Somebody who he thought would never listen, he said. Then he started finding the reasons why it could be Mekel. And he treated students differently than he treated general people. On this point, Rav Schechter brings the following. Ukeinza shamati shepam haita isha mevugeret balat shuva shad shehitzlicha lehishta. I'm on page 8. Ad shehitzlicha lehishtadech chofu avrua leha kama shanim. Rav Schechter says he heard a story about a woman, an elderly woman who became a balat shuva. Until she finally got married, she was advanced in age. Va'ad shenitabra gamkin avru kama shanim, until she became pregnant, some time went by, which means you're talking about a woman who's not that young, where the incidence of having a baby would some kind of problems increases dramatically. Uke'et heina shama meherofe sha'opi b'dikatav hitberesha ubra yuvlad b'mum chamor ma'od. That the doctors did a test and they found out that the baby will be born with extreme birth defects. V'ratzta ishav b'hapalat ha'ubar, and the woman wanted to have an abortion. V'tulfein rofe achad mi'amerika l'sh'ol al'pi hagon Rav Shlomo Zalman Orebach b'zeh. And her doctor called up Rav Shlomo Zalman to ask what to do. Hagon hishivo halo kfar yadata et da'ati b'noseh hazeh. He goes, you know my opinion on this. Sheikir rofe mishnot shiuto ba'aretz, because this doctor had spent many years in Israel, and he knew Rav Shlomo Zalman, and he knew that he thought it was murder, and he knew that there was no way that Rav Shlomo Zalman would allow it. She'ein b'zeh makom l'hatir. Rav Shlomo Zalman al-Rabach felt there was absolutely no way to allow this case, to allow. Chazar v'shelo harofe, od hapam, al-kol arichut ha-sipur, heich sheshatat chakad gola hizeh. He nonetheless went and told the whole story again and tried to explain how this is really an extreme situation. Shabbat Shuvahi, v'chule, v'chule, v'chule. How this woman is a balat shuva, and there's a whole tragedy in this. And v'ulay b'shatat chak, shekizeh yesh makom ulay letzadeh lehitera. And maybe in such a case, because of the difficulties, one can allow it. On how Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, heich shayech lakel b'shatat chak, al d'vashu asur barur. He goes, how can you, just because it's an extreme situation, you can't allow something which isn't allowed. Chazar hala v'ta'an od hapam v'lo ba'al tshuva hi ha'isha. He tried again. He goes, but she's a ba'al tshuva. Maybe still you can find some reason to be megel. V'lay al kol panim yesh kan tzad kula. Maybe there's a reason to let. V'lay kedai di l'tafein el kvod harav l'machar b'shazu. And the doctor finally said, I'll call you back. Think about it. Doctor is probably very smart here. This ulay meshach hayom tira ezet sad lahakel, and maybe over the next day, you'll find some way to be mekel. Anar of Shlomo Zalman Orbach, nu tov yekid verecha. By the way, I can hear him saying that. I can hear him absolutely speaking like that. Titalfein lemachar, achar avur hayom, chazar v'tofein elav harofe. He called him back. Va'omer lehagon zal, Rav Shlomo Zalman said, tagid leisha sheyesh posek mufursam v'yushalayim. There's a great posek in Yushalayim, b'shem harav Roldenberg. Shematira tahapala benidan shela, who would allow an abortion in this case? V'lo tagidla filu sheni chalek b'davar. Don't say a word. Don't even say that I argue with him. Shere ishazu inen mitamida. She's not my student. Shetiek fufa la rochili. Who said that she has to listen to me? Who said she's not my student? There's a great rabbi here. She can listen to Rav Oldenburg. You like? What's it? First of all, you see the greatness in Rav Shlomo Zalman over here. Look, on the one hand, what's his immediate feeling? His immediate feeling is, you're talking about murder. If you're talking about murder, I cannot allow this. I know of a case where a woman became a Balat Tshuva. It's not this case. She became a Balat Tshuva. She was in one of the seminaries in Israel. And by the time she was already religious, she would still had to pay the price for certain indiscretions a number of months before. She realized that she's pregnant, and now she's religious. She's in her early 20s, not exactly this case. And she doesn't know what to do. So she calls up her local rabbi back home, who she had beginning to have a relationship with, and he sent her to a certain person in America who told her, she said, my life will be ruined because as a single mother trying to find a shidduch, and, you know, my life will be ruined. And I just feel an incredible amount of pressure, and I feel that, again, I feel that almost too suicidal because I don't know what I'll do with myself. And when he heard that, the posek said, fine, you can have an abortion. Her teachers in the seminary that she was heard about this, went to Shlomo Zalman. Shlomo Zalman said, what are you talking about? You don't want to raise the baby? Fine, we'll find a home for the baby. There's many, many families that'll be willing to raise a Jewish child. Just, you know, we'll find a place for you, we'll put up, we'll take care, you won't have any expense in this, and it'll be fine. That's what her teachers came back and told her. And she said no. So Rav Shlomo Zalman asked to meet with her. He sat with her. Literally, he was crying and saying, but there's a life over here. And he said to her, you received a psak from your Rav, I will not argue with you. You are allowed to follow that psak. But if you ask me what I feel, I just feel that it's not worth relying on such a psak. But you are absolutely permitted to. Again, he laid out both sides, and then she had an abortion. Again, these situations are not at all simple. But over here, Rav Shlomo Zalman recognizes that there's another position. Again, the interesting thing in halacha is, okay, so who said that she's my student? Who said she has to follow me? I had a similar case to this. Nothing to do with abortion, and I don't want to get into details, because it's even better than abortion. But it had to do with also with who somebody can marry and whatever. And it was a very similar thing. And Rav Adi Yosef has a particular psak, and most rabbis disagree. And there's a girl who's not even a Bala Tshuva. She's almost a Bala Tshuva. And basically, what's so bad if she follows Rav Avadia? It's not like somebody else is her rabbi already. No one else is. So let her follow Rav Avadia. Yeah. There's a lot more to discuss about this. But by the way, I do want to add one thing, and then I want to get to the last thing for today. So much of medicine today, especially in America, is dictated by malpractice considerations and legal issues more so than medical issues sometimes, unfortunately, especially within this field. And it's easier for doctors to say there may be a problem, better off aborting, than running the risk of having responsibility afterwards for not saying where there could have been a problem and then being sued afterwards. And I mean, this is something that we, when my wife was pregnant with our first, which goes back 19 years ago, and we happened to be in America for the summer, and she needed to see someone while she was there, and they happened to say, look, I can run these tests as well. And we innocently thought, okay, why not? Want to run more tests? Sounds great. And then to get back the results and be told, well, there's an increased chance of such and such and such. And all that it does to you is puts you in this, you know, this terrible, terrible state. While, of course, the increased chance that they were talking about was a lower percentage than having a spontaneous abortion by even having the Dmei Shafir. How do you say that in English? Having the amnio, right. But again, they have to protect themselves legally, which is a very sad comment, because if you're talking about an increased chance of a problem, you just now went up from 1 in 3 million pregnancies to 1 in 250,000 pregnancies, you still, in your mind now it's 50-50. It's not, it becomes a 50-50 problem, and yes?
No, I have a question about Schefter's
yes.
story here. If she were not a Balak Shiva, she were from birth,
yeah.
Would that have changed things?
I don't think so, but I think that the issue over here is that fundamentally he's saying that if somebody is my student, somebody, I am their Rav, then the relationship would be such that I would have to give them my psak. If they're not my student, and they're not looking for my psak, they want to know what halacha is, I'm permitted to say that this person allows this in this case. I will admit to you right now, I give different psakim for people regarding one, when they come to visit Israel, to keep one day or two. Most people, I would tell them one day. Because I think the second day is a chumrah. Yeah, most people, I tell them one day, because I think it's a chumrah, and the purpose of a chumrah is to bring you closer to God. And most people keeping this chumrah will feel like idiots, and will not feel closer to God by it. So, now there are some people, there are some people who will love it, who say, hold it, I get to keep, you know, I get to do this, I remember my father keeping a day and a half, he loved keeping a day and a half. I make this bracha, I don't make this bracha. It was such excitement for him, right? Remember those? It was like the greatest thing that happened. Like, he gets to think about everything. But for most people, they just feel like idiots. Chassidim are driving around on... Yeah, Chassidim are driving around on cards, talking cell phones, but you're not, yeah. Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. So the poskim absolutely take this into consideration. Not only if a woman's life is in danger physically, but psychologically if her life will be in danger. Now that's something which is very difficult to be able to determine. Because to say that your life will be changed, your life will be in turmoil, your life will be different, is one thing. But actually that, you know, somebody consulted me recently. They have four children, and they were thinking about having a fifth child. And the woman told me that she had postpartum depression after the previous birth, and she lost 40 pounds after the previous birth that she put on, and she was and her whole self image is. Her husband never knew she had postpartum depression. Just like it was. Don't. I can explain to you, but I won't. Right. The husband never heard the words before. I said, you know, your wife having another child, do you realize what women can do with postpartum depression? What they can do to themselves, what they can do to the child?
Right.
I said, I am very hesitant to encourage her to get pregnant at this point because of her, you know, her own well-being, her own mental state. But and I'm telling you, the husband, yeah, you're right. She does have mood swings, and she does get depressed, and she does cry a lot. Okay, go on Google and look up the words postpartum depression, and you may have a revelation right now. But the psychological issue is absolutely critical in this, and it's very difficult to determine. It's not the simplest thing. The last thing that we're not going to get to today, which we'll touch, is Rav Moshe's tshuva regarding the Siamese twins. Just a little introduction to this. And we're not going to do this next time, so don't bother me about it. The reason why this is interesting is because co-joined twins does happen every now and again, and then they have long discussions about it. This was a family in Lakewood, New Jersey, who had co-joined twins. They were immediately flown to Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, where the chief of surgery was none other than Dr. Koop, who later on became Surgeon General of the United States. the whole tshuva over here is fascinating. Dr. Koop asked all of the staff to go clarify their own religious issues involved. They had to get a whole team together. And the team kept on pushing, let's get this done as soon as possible. The exact situation here that you need to know is they were joined by the chest, and they shared one heart. The heart, correct, the heart that they shared was a larger heart with six chambers, and there is no way that you can just separate them, that the second baby would definitely die. If they stayed together, they would both certainly die. If you look on the top of page 12, this is Rabbi Tendler, Rabbi Moshe Tendler writing, but look on top of page 12, he writes, I recall how impressed I was with a statement Dr. Koop made, a statement that in my opinion revealed the man's personality and also created special merit. With a team of 20 or so professionals, we're waiting for Feinstein's decision, and indeed we're expressing impatience at the lapse of time, which interfered with their private professional life significantly. Dr. Koop quieted the group with the following statement. The ethics and morals involved in this decision are too complex for me. I believe they are too complex for you as well. Therefore, I referred it to an old rabbi in the Lower East Side of New York. He's a great scholar, a saintly individual. He knows how to answer such questions. When he tells me, I too will know. Basically, Dr. Koop turned to Rav Moshe, because again, you read through the whole tshuva over here, but he kept asking him the right questions, and he kept asking the moral issues. Basically, Rav Moshe's question was like this: if you don't have the surgery, will they both die? The answer was yes. If you do have the surgery, could you choose which one to save? Which means, can you decide to save baby B, or can you decide to save baby A? And the answer was that baby B is not going to live, that baby A can live. Can live if you separate it. Rav Moshe's decision in the end went back to what we studied today. And he says something which to me really was incredible. So let's look on the bottom of page, no, it's the top of page 11. Okay. 11. The bottom of page 10 started with the Mishnah that we studied today. The top of page 11 did the Gemara. The Talmud in Sanhedrin elaborates on this mission by posing the question, why should you not sacrifice the infant even though the head has already been presented, since the infant is endangering the life of the mother? Is not the infant then a rodev? The law of the pursuer should apply, which is to kill the pursuer in order to save the life of the victim. The Talmud answers, no, heaven is the pursuer. In other words, this is an act of Hashem, and therefore it is not correct to assume that the fetus is the attacker. We cannot decide to favor either the child or the mother in this terrible dilemma. While the child is in the uterine environment, totally dependent yet on the mother's life, yet threatening it, we classify the fetus as a pursuer. The logic is, as Maimonides says, simple. While in the uterine environment, the child is totally dependent on the mother's life forces. Thus, either the mother's death or the fetus's death would result in a fetus that was non-viable. The complete dependency on the mother, so that if the mother dies, the fetus will also die, is the reasoning. No, keep on reading. Will also die. Is the reason for giving the mother priority to the fetus because she is the source of fetal life? Once the head appears, however, and the child is able to breathe independently, he's treated as an entity separate from the mother. He is now dependent on the mother's circulatory and respiratory systems. We grant him the full rights and privileges of an adult. The most important of these privileges is the right to life. He ends up saying, we'll skip the next paragraph, go to the right. Feinstein compared the case of Siamese twins to this classic case of conflict for survival between the mother and childbirth and the fetus. Baby A had no independent ability to survive. Her entire survival was completely dependent on her sister, who had the circulatory system to back up the functioning of the heart and liver. which means Rav Moshe ended up saying that what we studied today, which again, abortion, he ended up saying that the thing about the fetus is that it's dependent upon the mother. Therefore, the co-joined twin, who's dependent upon the circulatory system of the other one, has the same status as the fetus, which is remarkable. Because again, we saw the distinction between being in, being out, being life, not being a life. Rav Moshe, who again, you saw how strict he was with abortion, allowed the babies to be separated in this case, because he determined that the relationship halachically between these two babies was one of mother and fetus, because he says it's essentially the same case. As I said, this comes from the same Rav Moshe who wouldn't allow the abortion. In this case, he sees it as being a rodef, that one baby has a chance to survive. The thing which is preventing survival is the other baby, who is, you know, really wearing down the first baby, and therefore he said it's the same case, and he allowed the babies to be survived. You can read this whole thing through on your own. I think it's a very interesting postscript to the discussion that we had today. We'll lead Nedra next week. I'll try to get you more English sources, but I'm lying to you. Next week we'll try to do some end of life issues. Okay.
Thank you. Just a very, very important scheduling notification. With regards to Tuesday's full day rule, given the situation in the north, we have switched the idea.